rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, here's where it gets strange. The Syrians protecting the U.S. Embassy in Damascus. Islamic militants attempted to storm the U.S. Embassy in Damascus. From the Associated Press. But were unable to breach the embassy's high walls. Four guards, all Syrian, were killed. Tragic. And last night, of course, George W. Bush interrupted the ABC mockudrama, or crocudrama, whatever you want to call this thing, to what? Crow? I'm not sure. He did, however, make one interesting rhetorical point that I think is worth revisiting, or worth visiting on behalf of all of us. By the way, welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you, 7 minutes past the hour. It's the 12th of September, the day after 9/11. And so yesterday, 9/11 was the, you know, the whole, it was all 9/11 all day, right? Wall to wall. And of course, George W. Bush had to give a political speech. The day when you would think we would be remembering the death of a couple of thousand, almost 3,000 people, instead, and by the way, if the way things are going, we will soon hit the exact same number in Iraq, which Bush kind of spoke to last night, America of American War did, in a somewhat tragic fashion last night. You would think that on the day that he would be speaking to the families or of the families, that we would be remembering the dead, like the memorial at Oklahoma City, you know, for the annual memorials that are held for the people who died there, rather than going off on a screed about Tim McVeigh's bizarre right-wing ideology and how we have to declare war against Tim McVeigh's right-wing ideology. Wait, Tim McVeigh actually was part of a large right-wing terrorist movement inside the United States that is still here and is still intact. But Clinton didn't want to give them any PR. He didn't want to give them exactly what they wanted. Bush, on the other hand, seems to have an obsession with giving bin Laden everything he wants. Bin Laden, in 1996, said in the New York Times, he said that we had to get our troop, the troops that were placed there in 1991 by Bush Sr. so that they could stage to eject Iraq from Kuwait, at the Prince Bandar Air Force Base, I believe it's called, or Bandar, Bin Sultan Bandar, whatever, that those troops, bin Laden said, get those troops out of Saudi Arabia. They're defiling the Holy Land. If you don't, I'm going to attack you. And you've got women driving, and you've got men drinking alcohol, and this is just unacceptable. And also, raise the price of oil. Newt Gingrich said that bin Laden wanted it at $200 a barrel. I think he was exaggerating a bit. Seems like around $80 a barrel is what most people think bin Laden was talking about. He believed that by getting oil for $17 a barrel, as we were when Bush came into office, that we were basically stealing the natural resources of the Holy Land of Saudi Arabia. So raise the price of oil and get the troops out. Well, the price of oil is up, and 6-8 months ago, Bush pulled all of our troops out of Saudi Arabia with no fanfare whatsoever, virtually no public announcement. So bin Laden got what he wanted. Plus, you know, hey, please don't catch me. And, you know, the only time we actually had bin Laden in the crosshairs, we actually had an opportunity to catch or kill him, was at Tora Bora. And Bush flinched on that one, let him get away. And they're still, you know, trying to figure out the history on that thing. That somehow didn't make it into the mockudrama, you know, it's the mockumentary. So anyhow, so here's Bush last night about 9/11.
I'm often asked why we're in Iraq when Saddam Hussein was not responsible for the 9/11 attacks.
Yeah, that's a fair question. Why? And probably, yeah. Actually, I would say a more important question is, why is it that about a third of Americans, in some surveys as many as half of Americans, think that somehow Saddam Hussein had something to do with the 9/11 attacks? And, you know, at least finally, Bush is saying that they didn't. But good question. Why are we in Iraq? Well, here's Bush's answer last night.
The answer is that the regime of Saddam Hussein was a clear threat.
A clear threat. and the nature of that threat. Because now we look back, I mean, here we are in 2006, and, I mean, this is not 2002 or 2003. This is, we've spent over $1 billion, that's with a B, $1,000 million just looking for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That was the budget for the two investigations, the Dulfer investigation and the one that preceded it. These two investigations in Iraq where they went, where are the weapons of mass destruction? What was Saddam up to? Let's go through the records. Let's get translators in there. Let's read all the papers that we can find, raid the offices, pull everything we can get out. There must be some evidence here someplace that he was doing something. Maybe he spirited it out of the country. Who knows? Well, we did have the no-fly zone. We were flying over the area 24 hours a day, 24/7 since 1991. No, he didn't move anything out of the country. Sorry. And we didn't find anything. So what was the threat? It turns out what Saddam was doing in the two years leading up to our invasion of Iraq in the spring of 2003, what he was doing was writing a romance novel, which is, by the way, now in print. But that's not what George W. Bush said he was doing. What George W. Bush said he was doing was representing a threat to the United States.
As a condition for ending the Persian Gulf War, the Iraqi regime was required to destroy its weapons of mass destruction, to cease all development of such weapons, and to stop all support for terrorist groups.
And it turns out that with the singular exception of sending $20,000 to the families of suicide bombers in Israel, something that was also being done in much larger fashion by folks in Saudi Arabia and several other countries in the Middle East, with the single exception of that, Saddam had complied with that. He had done away with the weapons of mass destruction. He had stopped developing them. Scott Ritter came in. He blew up stuff. They let the inspectors, go all over the country. But that didn't deter Bush from saying
the Iraqi regime has violated all of those obligations.
Not so.
It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons.
No, they don't.
It is seeking nuclear weapons.
No, sorry, you're wrong. But Bush did his best to conflate it to 9/11, you'll recall.
We must also never forget the most vivid events of recent history. On September the 11th, 2001, America felt its vulnerability, even to threats that gather on the other side of the earth.
So in your Iraq speech, you mentioned 9/11, Mr. Bush, and why? Now, this is, keep in mind, this is just before we invaded Iraq. So why would George W. Bush be mentioning 9/11? Just before he's going to talk about Saddam, is he going to go back and talk about Saddam Hussein again? Is there some kind of conflation here?
First, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons.
That's a good question, especially since they don't have terrible weapons, but in any case.
While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
Well, actually, it stands alone because it's all alone because it's not a threat.
If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons?
Yeah, the tragedy of the doctrine of preemptive war, last used among major Western nations by Adolf Hitler. The tragic doctrine of preemptive war.
This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons and is capable of killing millions. We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents.
No, actually they were sold to them by your daddy, and Don Rumsfeld went over there and shook the guy's hand and made it all work. But they did have the stuff, but it's all gone now.
Including mustard gas.
Yeah.
Sarin nerve gas.
Yeah, I know. You've got the receipts.
EX nerve gas.
Yeah, you've got the receipts and all the paperwork your father gave you. I understand.
We've also discovered through intelligence.
Oh, this is a killer. This is the balsa wood model airplane that Uday or Kusei had, the 20-foot balsa wood airplane. They thought it was going to come to get us.
That Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
Yep, and Scott Ritter, when Bush said that, he was on our program, and he said he's talking about Kusei's or Uday's, I forget which one. He's talking about Kusei's model airplane. And it turned out, yep, sure enough, Dolfer gets over there and looks around. Yep, there was a model airplane. It was his toy. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
If you wasn't listening, that's the problem anyway. While you're searching under every stone and alone, nearly in a prison chain like a dog. Never saw no weapon, that's what the experts say. Rummy ditch, so is dick. One more life to do the trick. Never saw no weapon, that's what the experts say.
Yeah, I never saw no weapons at all, but then you can never forget.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and therefore Bush out there saying, you know, be afraid, be very afraid, you got to be afraid, you got to be afraid, Saddam's going to get you, by the way, and he tried to kill my daddy, we got to get him, you know, he's sitting on a lot of oil, but frankly, one of the most important things from the Bush point of view, actually, I would say from the neocon point of view, this is one of those areas where I'm willing to believe that Bush got dragged into this agenda, or got sucked into this agenda, rather than he was advancing it himself. Bush saw 9/11 as an opportunity to gain political capital. I mean, and Iraq as well. You have to ask the question, you know, why the invasion of Iraq? Well, from Bush's point of view, it was all about politics. It was all about getting power. Here, for example, this is Cindy Sheehan testifying before John Conyers' congressional inquiry into the invasion of Iraq, quoting Mickey Herskowitz, who was the biographer that the Bush family hired to write A Charge to Keep, which is Bush's official autobiography, which is in bookstores right now.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote. It looks like George Bush is ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president.
That from Cindy Sheehan, you know, making the observation that her son, who had joined the Army in 2000, was apparently doomed from the outset, tragically. So Bush was in it for the political power that he could get out of being a war president. He very much wanted to be Franklin Roosevelt. In fact, he's constantly comparing himself to Franklin Roosevelt. The neocons, however, they wanted a clean slate. They wanted a tabula rasa. They wanted something, a blank piece of paper on which they could write neocon paradise. This is what we're going to do. We're going to create, you know, a flat 15% income tax. We're going to do away with the social welfare programs. We're going to do away with food subsidies. We're going to throw the poor to the wolves, and that'll give them the incentive to stop being poor. And we're going to let the corporations do anything they want, and that'll give them the incentive to do all those marvelous things that corporations do, like make money. And we're going to throw open the borders, and we're going to say there's no such thing as an illegal alien or immigrant here in Iraq. Anybody can come in and work for anything they want, so the corporations can bring in labor from Bangladesh and from Sri Lanka and from Pakistan and from wherever they can find the cheapest labor. And sure enough, not a single Iraqi working on the largest construction project in Iraq right now, which is this 21-building, 109-acre site. The so-called U.S. Embassy, it's a city within a city on the most valuable land, the prime land, right on the Tigris River, right on the banks of the river, right there in downtown Baghdad, inside the green zone, probably the most valuable, square footage, millions, that just happened to be given to us as a gift from the Iraqi government, our friends. Not a single Iraqi working on that project. Bechtel, Halliburton, all these American companies, a lot of American contractors, and where are they getting their labor? They're bringing them in from as far away as Vietnam, as Asia. But most of them from Central Asia, from Pakistan, from Sri Lanka. None of them Iraqis, though, and we wonder why the Iraqis are a little upset with us. But Bush knew, he told us, that there's a real danger here. There's a real, real danger here.
Iraq has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes and other equipment needed for gas centrifuges.
Gotta watch out for that equipment.
Which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons. If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year.
And why should we be so worried about Iraq? Is it 9/11?
We've experienced the horror of September the 11th.
Ah, yes.
We have seen that those who hate America are willing to crash airplanes into buildings full of innocent people.
And therefore we must attack Iraq?
Facing clear evidence of peril.
Yes.
We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Now, that, of course, all coming just before the invasion of Iraq. Then last night...
I'm often asked why we're in Iraq when Saddam Hussein was not responsible for the 9/11 attacks. The answer is that the regime of Saddam Hussein was a clear threat.
A clear threat to whom? Of what form? Maybe you know. Give us a call. 866-440-THOM. Our telephone number, 440-8466. Our live chat room at TomHartman.com. 27 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
The war goes on, no end in sight. Missions accomplished, everything's all right. He's busy reading my pet joke. How the hell did you get your book? Never saw no weapon, that's what the experts say. But W wasn't listening, let's bomb them anyway. While you're searching under every stone and log, you nearly hit a prisoner, chain him like a dog. Never saw no weapon, that's what the experts say.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. So George W. Bush last night addressing the nation.
I'm often asked why we're in Iraq when Saddam Hussein was not responsible for the 9/11 attacks. The answer is that the regime of Saddam Hussein was a clear threat.
Well, let's ask one of the folks who was actually promoting that meme pretty aggressively, Frank Gaffney. He's the founder of and president of the Center for Security Policy. He is also a founding member of the Project for a New American Century, also sometimes referred to as PNAC. He's a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, the group that Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney back in the 1970s were using to claim that the Soviets had secret weapons of mass destruction, a secret submarine that was undetectable. Turned out that that was a phony thing to be afraid of. And a columnist with the Washington Times, Frank Gaffney, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for the great send-up, Tom.
There you go. You've got a long career here, Frank, and you've done a lot of work. And I'm actually believing or assuming that you're doing this, believing that this is the best thing for America.
Well, that would be a safe assumption. Yes.
Okay, so you guys have a new TV ad out. Let me just play some pieces of it and let's talk about it here. This is the new Center for Security Policy TV ad. It starts out like this.
Since 9/11, most Americans know the world is a dangerous place.
Now, do you think, Frank, really, that most Americans before 9/11 didn't think that America was? I mean, I remember in second grade diving under my desk in school, you know, covering my eyes and ears so that the atomic blast wouldn't get me, back when your Committee on the Present Danger was scaring us.
Tom, I believe that most Americans, and this might even include you, thought when the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Union collapsed that that was pretty much the end of the problem. You had people like Colin Powell, who was then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, saying after Saddam Hussein was driven out of Kuwait, I'm running out of enemies. It was safe to cash in the peace dividend, to reduce our military forces. I think most Americans, in fact, before 9/11, were living with a false sense of security, partly as a result of bad leadership.
And you're suggesting that things like the Star Wars program that you're a big advocate of would have prevented 14 guys with box cutters, 19 guys with box cutters from hijacking an airplane?
Oh, I don't think so. It wasn't supposed to, and it would have been a miracle if it could have. But I think a missile defense system could prevent the next and far more devastating attack, which I believe some of these guys have in mind for us, namely one that could devastate the United States as a whole. As we talk about in our book, War Footing, possibly using what's called an electromagnetic pulse attack to shut down our electrical system coast to coast. That's the sort of thing, Tom. It is scary. I'm not saying it to scare people. I'm saying it because I think if people in this country, particularly the electorate in this country, are unaware of real things that are happening, real capabilities that people are developing, real vulnerabilities that we have, they can't possibly make informed decisions as voters, and we may well find ourselves following courses of actionist national policy that leave us in even greater danger than we are today.
We're talking to Frank Gaffney at centerforsecuritypolicy.org, the website. Frank, let's continue with the ad here.
Islamic terrorists hate us for who we are and what we stand for.
I thought they hated us for our foreign policy. Osama bin Laden said specifically and explicitly on numerous occasions that his opposition to the United States was an opposition to the fact that, number one, we were supporting a corrupt regime in Saudi Arabia, which is a direct result of our addiction to foreign oil. Number two, that we had stationed troops at Prince Bandar Air Force Base in Saudi Arabia, and, you know, men were watching pornography and drinking alcohol, and women were driving around showing their elbows, and this was unacceptable to him. It was a defiling of the Holy Land. And Bush, by the way, 7-8 months ago, pulled all those guys out, so bin Laden got what he wanted. And number three, that the price of oil was too cheap. He wanted $80 a barrel oil because he felt that we were stealing the wealth of the Holy Land of Saudi Arabia, and Bush gave him that too. What does that have to do with, you know, hating us for who we are?
I think you've been treated to a selective rendering of bin Laden's agenda, and bin Laden, after all, is just one manifestation of a phenomenon I call Islamofascism, a political totalitarian movement that is far wider and far more dangerous than he and his little band of followers.
Why fascism, though? I mean, fascism is the merger of corporate and state interests. It's a word that Benito Mussolini invented. Mussolini and Franco were, you know, the world's preeminent fascists. They were proud of it. It's the fascism in some ways has a long and honorable tradition, I guess. And there's people in the United States who are, you know, aggressively advocating it. The Grover Norquists of the world who think that government functions should be privatized and corporations should be brought in doing these things. Why connect Islam with fascism when Islam is actually, this particular strain of Islam, is theocratic, not fascist? It's a very different thing.
Well, Tom, you and I have talked about this before. We can debate, if you'd like, which of the various strains of totalitarianism to identify with this particular
But fascism doesn't mean totalitarian. It means corporate state merger.
And what this form of totalitarianism has in mind is the merger of everything.
This is church state merger. That's theocracy.
You asked me a question. Let me answer the question. Phenomenon that envisions the domination of all aspects of life, society, business, by the religious leadership. Islamo, because it is dressing itself up as part of the Muslim faith. Fascism, because it is practicing the kinds of totalitarian techniques vis-a-vis the state, vis-a-vis the society, vis-a-vis all other aspects, including business, that is, I think, correctly described as fascistic. But here's the main point, Tom, and I think it's something that I hope your audience is paying attention to. We're dealing with people who seek to take over the world, the Muslim world, for sure, and the rest of us in due course. And that political agenda is, first and foremost, I think, what we've got to be designing strategies to counter. If you don't understand that that's the nature of what we're up against, if you want to give them all a pass, or you want to think it's just because they're angry about our foreign policies, and if only we'd stop those foreign policies.
You think Bin Laden wants to sit in the White House and run the United States?
I beg your pardon?
You think Bin Laden wants to sit in the White House and run the United States?
Well, they say they would like to. I'm sorry?
Yeah, I just finished reading Messages to the World, the collected writings of Osama bin Laden. And I tell you, it was hard reading, because, you know, he's long, eloquent, not even eloquent, just, you know, long-winded stuff. There was never any reference in there, ever. And I'm telling you, I actually read the thing. You know, some 300 pages of it.
Again, of a
description on bin Laden's part of a desire to run the United States. What he wanted was to run us out of his territory.
I hate to keep pointing this out to you, but bin Laden is only one part of the problem. He is an example of Islamofascism. He is
okay,
not
so who's the other Islamist who wants to run the United States? Is it Musharraf in Pakistan?
Guys who think that if we just take bin Laden out, that'll be the end of it, don't understand the problem. Guys who think bin Laden's screeds are the only font of the true direction of this movement don't understand it.
The Wahhabists don't want us.
May I just make one point? Take a look at a film called Obsession, Radical Islam's War Against the West.
You mean the one blurbed by Newt Gingrich?
Which has as its backdrop much of the footage that comes out of the various Islamofascist organs.
Yeah, I saw it on the web, Frank, and it just strikes me as the same kind of stuff that the Committee for the Present Danger was producing back in the 70s about be afraid of the Soviets.
Tom, one of the things that it makes very clear, in the words of the Islamofascists themselves, if they see the White House being taken over and having the flag of Islam flying over it, and the black mosques, the black stone dominating the world.
You don't think that those folks on that side could produce this stuff. The information is present.
If you wish to ignore it, that's your business. But
Frank, you don't think that on the other side those guys could find equally loony... That those guys could find equally loony Americans here and there who would, you know, quoting, for example, the white separatists, the white power movement, and put together a movie about how America is trying to take over all of the Middle East. And, you know,
Tom, the difference is that the stuff that I'm describing is being put out on the state television networks of some of the countries that have immense resources at their disposal, like Saudi Arabia.
Well, I want to argue with you, Frank, that they're putting out anti-Israel stuff.
White, radical types. This is the country that we keep talking about as our ally.
So we have about 30 seconds. We have about 20 seconds, Frank. Is the solution to just bomb them into oblivion?
No, I don't think so. I think to the contrary. If you troubled to read War Footing, since you're such a big reader, I would recommend it to you. Take a look at this as a formula for doing something about this problem that does not involve bombing all these people into the Stone Age. In fact,
Step one.
One chapter out of 10 that talks about the military at all.
Step one. What's in a few seconds here? I'm sorry.
Step one is knowing who the enemy is, which is what we've just been talking about. Step two is the military, and the rest of it deals with other tools from economic to political warfare to diplomacy that can be used to defeat these people.
Frank Gaffney, website centerforsecuritypolicy.org. Frank, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Nice to see you.
45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Have you had enough
of hypocrisy?
Have you had enough
of the spit and the
screen? Have you had enough?
desert.
Have you had enough?
Or the rubber stamp?
Have you had enough?
The wiretap?
If you've had enough, then it's time to throw the rascals out.
Have you had enough?
Cause they're all corrupt.
Have you had enough?
Or be
you
tipsy
dog? Have you had enough? Then it's time to throw the rascals out.
Yes, have you had enough of these Republicans? Have you had enough of these cons? Time to throw the rascals out. Welcome back, my friends. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Tom Hartman radio program. And 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian.
Hi. Well, I have an idea of maybe why Saddam is a threat, or was a threat.
Okay.
Could it be he controlled enough oil that he could stop Bush and his cronies from setting the price of oil at whatever they wanted to?
Good point. Then, and it's been made by others, and I think that there may be something to that, that by flooding the market, the world markets with oil, Saddam Hussein had the ability to produce substantial, I think it was 3 million barrels a day, that could keep the price of oil low. So we seized Iraq in order to raise the price of oil. Interesting one. Andy in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Tom. You're a great American, my friend.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, where do you find these people? That guy sounded like Darth Vader. Every time he'd breathe, he'd be like...
You know, come on. You know. Give him credit. He was willing to come on the program.
Yeah, I give
most,
him that.
Most of these
what?
Cons are afraid to come on the program.
Yeah, well, he's wrong. All he is about fear, and more fear. And, you know, we don't need fear. We need people that are going to solve the problems, communicate with other people. You know, them people have been over there for centuries.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know,
and they haven't been coming here. I agree.
Right.
Well said, Andy. Thank you very much. In fact, apropos.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
And this, by the way, was a statement FDR made not about World War II, but about the Great Depression. Hank in Door, Michigan. Hey, Hank.
Hey, Tom. Comments on Frank the Boogeyman there. You know, a lot of stuff that he claims that's going on with Islam, you can turn it right around and you, like you mentioned, looked right at our own government. And a lot of things that are coming out of there, they're exactly the same. A lot of the stuff that is going on.
Well, that's the thing. It can be framed either way on both sides. And if we just were to develop alternative energy technologies and get the heck out of the Middle East, I really don't think that the folks in the Middle East would, you know, give a whit about us. I don't think that they would care. And,
right, but like Frank said there, he has his own agenda, and it's like, you know, he's talking down to you like, you know, I know what I'm talking about, and you know nothing, and you better read, you know, you better read up on it before, you know, the end of the world comes here. So,
yeah, I know.
You held your own against there, so.
Well, thank you. Thank you,
thank you for the time.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Lee in Vancouver, British Columbia. Hey, Lee.
Yeah, this is in reference to Frank Gaffney. You know, the last caller basically summed up part of what I wanted to say. But, you know, the most important thing to me is that the style of argument, the so-called argument that he used, and it's constantly being used, you would ask him a question, and then he would go running off about all kinds of silliness, but never would answer your question. Like when you had, you know, and your questions were a lot of times in response to things that he had said, for instance. When you said, he said that Osama bin Laden would like to, you know, run the White House, you know. And you ask him, well, where did he say that? And then he starts off on his blather. And never did bother to answer your question. Yeah. You know, it comes down to the kind of thing that Bush was doing last night in his speech when he was talking about Iraq. And, you know, like saying, well, Iraq was a clear threat to us, but he never said where.
Yeah, or how, or anything.
Or how, or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just a basic style of argument that people on the right use.
Yeah, it's called the straw man argument. Exactly. You instead of answering the question, you say what you want to say. Number one, and I'm not saying that Frank always did this. Frank Gaffney, at least I want to give him credit. Even he and I are exact opposite ends of the political spectrum. I mean, the guy's one of the founders of the Project for New American Century, but he is willing to come on the program and talk to me and talk to our listeners, and I do respect that. But the whole strategy of not answering questions and changing the topic and trying to filibuster, ultimately I don't think it works. I think that what happens is the listeners go, there's something funny with this. So Lee, I got to move along. Thanks for the call.
Take
I appreciate
care.
It. Carlos in West Orange, New Jersey. Hey, Carlos.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi. How you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
I was just wondering about this Islamic fascism thing that Bush. This guy was talking about.
Yeah.
The reason why I say that is because he's trying to say that through the terrorist act, they're going to take over this nation.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous. I mean, if that was the case, then Israel would have changed. Right? I mean,
it's really a different situation. I'm not sure it's a perfect parallel.
Well,
but the fact of the matter
is
America, if America falls, it's not going to be from without, it's going to be from within.
Exactly. That's what Lincoln said, right?
Yeah.
All right. So what I'm saying is that in order for them to change this nation, they have to change it, the idea, the way people think.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's why I think that they're using this term Islamofascism, because the real fascists and, the real fascists in the Bush administration, the real fascists on the right, don't like the fact that we're using that term to describe them. And so they're trying to reinvent it, they're trying to redefine it, and trying to, reshape it and carry it forward. And then, of course,
I'm often asked why we're in Iraq when Saddam Hussein was not responsible for the 9/11 attacks. The answer is that the regime of Saddam Hussein was a clear threat.
Yeah. But Uday Hussein had a balsa wood airplane, and, he could have flown that all the way over here to spray some anthrax on Pat Leahy again. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And a beautiful Monday to you. Today, 1963, Martin Luther King delivered his I Have a Dream speech. We will be hearing a clip of Dr. King a little later on in the program. Welcome back to our program here. Tom Hartman with you. He that would make his own liberty secure must guard even his enemy from oppression. For if he violates this duty, he establishes a precedent that will reach to himself. That from Thomas Paine, our quote for the day. Wesley J. Smith is with us. His website, wesleyjsmith.com, appropriately enough. He's an attorney and author of a new book, Forced Exit, Euthanasia, Assisted Suicide, and the new Duty to Die. Duty to Die, Wesley J. Smith?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, yeah, there is something in which I write about in that book called Futile Care Theory, which is sweeping this country and, in fact, is roiling Texas because they have a law that permits it, in which if a person wants life-sustaining medical treatment, and the bioethics committee of the hospital doesn't think that the quality of their life is worth living, then they want to be able to, these people who support futile care theory, refuse wanted life-sustaining treatment on that basis. So, yes, duty to die is something to consider. And, in fact, whether or not we have a so-called duty to die is being actively discussed in bioethics discourse.
But the issue at the legal level in the United States has only appeared in Oregon,
we're not talking about assisted suicide. We're talking about futile care theory, medical futility, where people who want life-sustaining treatment, and it's happening in Texas. If you go do a Google search, medical futility, you'll get all kinds of Texas cases where doctors and bioethics committees, and permitted by Texas law, are refusing wanted life-sustaining treatment that people want to maintain their lives. So So it is not the same thing as assisted suicide. It's a first cousin to assisted suicide, but it's a different public policy.
But you're opposed to physician-assisted suicide as well.
Of course.
And yet here in Oregon, our experience has been, and I've had a couple of people on this program who are very involved with the, they call it the Death with Dignity program.
I know that's what they call it. That's a euphemism, so go ahead.
Who have said that the number of suicides has actually gone down. What happens is that people are given life-ending medication. First of all, they have to have two doctors sign off on the fact that they're terminal within 6 months. And they get the medication and sit it on the, you know, on the counter next to the bed. And now they know that they have the ability to take their own lives. And so every day they say, well, I can put up with this for one more day and one more day and one more day. And the percentage of people who actually die natural deaths and the percentage of it has gone up and the percentage of people who commit suicide has actually gone down because people feel like they now have control over their own future. Why would you want the state to stick its nose in our business and tell us that we can't have control over our future like that?
Well, first off, you don't know what the heck is going on in Oregon because the only thing you know about the assisted suicide practice up there is what the death doctors, that is the doctors who write lethal prescriptions, tell the state.
I live
so,
here.
So you want to listen to an answer or do you want to interrupt?
I thought conversation involved an occasional interruption. What am I supposed to let you give a speech?
You're supposed to let me say more than one sentence at a time, because what you're talking about, you don't know about. You're making some kind of anecdotal statement when, in fact, nobody really knows what's going on in Oregon because the state conducts no independent investigation.
So you have come to Oregon and done a study?
And indeed destroys the documents as soon as they publish their yearly annual reports. So you don't know what's happening. Plus in Oregon, I don't know if you've noticed, pal, but you guys are having a terrible problem with elder suicide. You're having a terrible problem with youth suicide. So don't tell me suicide's going down in Oregon.
So you've come to Oregon and done a study, Wesley J. Smith?
I have read the studies that have actually been done, my friend. I have read the headlines in your papers bemoaning the fact, why would elderly people be killing themselves? Gee, I have no idea. Maybe because the state has said suicide is acceptable in some circumstances.
You've
got to know what you're talking about to interview me, so go ahead.
I just don't get it. Why you want the state telling me that criminal sanctions are going to come after me or anybody who helps me if I decide that at the end of my life, in great pain, knowing that I am terminal, I decide to leave a few weeks early.
Well, first off, that's not even what the assisted suicide advocates in Oregon say is happening. It's not about pain. If you've been reading the reports, pain is not the issue. That's how assisted suicide is sold. That's how people are scared into accepting the idea of assisted suicide, that it will be a last resort when nothing can be done to alleviate unbearable suffering. That's a false premise. You've got the hospice movement. You've got good pain control. There are things that people can do and should do.
Well, let's say I'm not in pain.
Why don't you let me finish a sentence? Maybe your audience would be able to learn something. And maybe you would learn something. You invited me on your show, and if you want to hear what
you solicited us to be on the show.
It's called courtesy, my friend. Courtesy. You invited me on as your guest, so let me speak. So if you want to go ahead and tell me what you think, go ahead. Your audience hears it all the time, so be my guest. Have fun. I'll listen.
Again.
Go ahead.
What if I'm trying to understand why you want the government to be coming into my house with the force of guns. I mean, you know, the government with the force of the government has the ability to use, you know, to use guns and put people in prison. Why you want the force of law to be used against me if I decide it's the end of my life? And let's even say I'm not in pain, but I'm going to die within a month or so, and there's no doubt about that, and I decide I'm going to leave early.
Well,
Why is that the government's business?
First off, the purpose of government is to protect the lives of all citizens. Secondly, there are study after study that show, for example, people with cancer who may want assisted suicide today, 3 weeks later are really glad they didn't commit it. It should be the government's job to engage in suicide prevention in all cases, not say, well, some suicides we agree with, and some suicides we don't. The intellectual premise of the two premises of the assisted suicide movement are as follows. Number one, what you've been talking about, this is my body, I own it, I can do what I want, personal autonomy. The second is that death can be an acceptable answer to personal suffering. So if that, those are the premises, what in the world does dying have to do with it? There are an awful lot of people who are suffering, quite particularly with existential suffering, that are going to suffer for far more intensely and far longer than dying people. This whole concept that it's going to be limited to the terminally ill is ridiculous when you think about it in the long term. And indeed, when you look at what's happened in the Netherlands over the last 33 years since they've been permitting this, they've now gotten to the point where doctors are assisting the suicides of people who are disabled, chronically ill, even depressed. So the idea that killing can be an acceptable answer to human suffering and the state should validate that is very dangerous. Secondly, the states throughout this country, and I'm sure still in Oregon, other than if somebody has cancer, can prevent suicide, and can prevent suicide not through criminal processes against the suicidal person who needs help, but through psychiatric.
No, I get all that, but you're suggesting that the purpose of government is not to protect our freedoms, but is to protect our health. If that's the case, Wesley Smith, why aren't you out campaigning tirelessly for national health care?
Actually, you don't know how I feel about national health care. I think we do need to improve access to health care for people who do not have access to it. I don't think that a NHS like in the UK, socialized medical system, will work. The NHS is collapsing, but I do think we need to have a combination of a private sector and public sector campaign or program so that people who are uninsured will be greatly reduced in number and more people have access to quality health care. I think that's a big crisis in this country.
Okay.
And is also a relevant issue in terms of assisted suicide.
And just for the record, you're suggesting to me that the physicians that I've spoken with on this program, on the radio, from Oregon here, who at least one of whom is never written a prescription for life-ending medication, who say that the statistics show that the number of people who are committing suicide, particularly elderly people, but also younger people who are terminal, has actually declined since we put into case physician-assisted suicide, that they're just making it up or they're lying.
The people committing suicide in Oregon declining, I have certainly seen no reports on that. What I have seen is, if you take a look, do a Google search of despair over the elderly.
Why would these guys lie about this?
I'm not saying they did lie. I don't know what they said. You might have
misinterpreted. I will tell you what they said. They said that people who get prescriptions for physician-assisted suicide. Are you not going to let me finish my sentence, sir?
Go ahead.
They said that it works both ways, right? They said that the number of people, when people get prescriptions for life-ending drugs, they are less likely to end up committing suicide. Before, it used to be that they'd shoot themselves.
Well, I have not heard those statistics. I'd love for somebody to send those to me, but it doesn't matter because what matters is...
It
doesn't matter.
Because it's all about your morality.
No, it's not about my morality. It's about public morality. You guys have made your decision in terms of your vote on Proposition 16, and you have your legalized assisted suicide. Someday you're going to rescind it because it's a terrible public policy. In the meantime, as assisted suicide advocates try to spread it around the country, we're resisting it, and we resisted it for more than 13 years. Maybe you ought to interview Greg Hamilton from Physicians for Compassionate Care in Oregon, who is a psychiatrist, who has written the only peer-reviewed article about a person who got poison prescription, and that man got the poison prescription 2 years before he died a natural death and was allowed to keep the poison prescription even though he was delusional.
Right. In other words,
and
he didn't use it. That's the whole point. In other words, he didn't use it. WesleyJSmith.com, the website, people want to learn more about it. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah,
17 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Suicide is painless. It brings on many changes. And I can take or leave it if I please.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. I gotta tell you, one of these days we're going to have a contest for the rudest right winger. I think Wesley J. Smith would win. I was having a hard time to stop laughing. I mean, it's just,
hey, you were invited on the,
excuse me, you solicited us to be on our program, sir. But nonetheless, isn't it amazing these guys? Oh, we're all about freedom. We're all about liberty. But you better not do something in the privacy of your own home we don't like. Like, having sex with somebody the same gender, or smoking pot, or committing suicide when you're terminally ill. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 866-440-8466. Ralph in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Ralph, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. This may be a little tough, but my father was a Lieutenant Colonel Army Chaplain. He and my mother are both buried in Arlington National Cemetery. My father was the administrative chaplain at Fort Snelling when the first Army chapel was ever built. He was largely responsible for raising all of the funds for it.
Mm-hmm.
My father was incredibly ethical and moral with all of the decisions that he made. He's one of the finest men I ever knew. Dad, in his final days, had to go to the VA hospital in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
He and my mother had talked extensively about just kind of going. Dad had written an article for the Watchman Examiner entitled Back from the Valley of the Shadow of Death. And in it he said, I don't have any fear of death. I've done my stuff. I feel comfortable with meeting my maker.
Right.
The United States Army in the Veterans Administration Hospital kept my father alive for 2 years. Dad was being fed through a tube down into his stomach, and he pulled it out of his nose several times. They tied his arms down to the slats of the bed.
Oh, man. In other words, he had reached the point where he did not want to live any longer.
Yes.
And they forced him to...
They forced him to live. And I have had to relive that damn thing ever since the Terry Schiavo thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There are a host of us, I suspect, who are out there who have had similar types of experiences. When I listen to the arrogant vomit of that particular individual that you just had on, mm-hmm. I am disgusted.
Yeah. I agree with you, Ron.
Because he can't even hold a candle to my father.
Yes. Yes. Ralph, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Yeah, I kind of hope it has an impact.
I suspect it has. Ralph, thank you very much.
Take care.
You too. Joe in Provo, Utah. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Tom. They want to apply laws to people that want to freely apply themselves to their lives and their destiny. But they refuse to apply themselves to the laws that exist when we apply our force on people against their will. I mean, I'm a Vietnam vet. I live with the fact that we slaughtered 5 million people in Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam with weapons of mass destruction. You know, and it was illegal what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And where were people like him when it comes time to dealing with life and death situations when it's illegal?
Yeah, well, the bottom line is, I think an awful lot of this is being driven, frankly, out of the Vatican, out of the Catholic Church, which believes that suicide is a sin, and they want to keep us from sinning. And if they have to come into our homes and hospitals with guns to stop us from sinning, they're going to do it.
Well, I'll tell you, I've gotten to the point with religion. I grew up Catholic, and then I went to synagogue to study in a synagogue for a while, and religion has meant a lot to my life, but I've gotten to the point where if religion isn't about world peace, what's the point? I don't have any room for it in my life. I'm tired of all this religion.
And, really that was the fundamental teaching of Jesus, who, the founder, arguably, of Christianity. Joe, good point. Thank you very much. Will in Pittsburgh. Hey, Will, we have about a minute left. What's up?
Who was that moron that called you? What was
his name was Wesley J. Smith, which is also his website.
Who does he work for, Tom?
I don't know. He's an attorney with the Discovery Institute, and he solicited our program to be on. And, I knew he was a right-winger and put him on, and he goes, he's written a new book. It's called Forced Exit, Euthanasia, Assisted Suicide, and the New Duty to Die.
Carmine, I only have, about 30 seconds?
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. My father went through that, and I think every person has a right to take their own life when they're terminally ill, and not just because they're in pain. You realize the economic genocide that in this country that healthcare inflicts upon us?
Oh yeah, the hospitals want to extract the last dollar. You know, another, to keep you alive for another 5 days, they get another 5 days worth of money from you. Will, thanks a lot for the money or for the call. I appreciate it. 27 minutes past the hour. It's a Tom Hartman radio program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie to bind. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
And welcome back. Talk radio for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. I drop into our live chat room at TomHartman.com. Our toll-free number, 866-440-8466, all across the United States of America. By the way, we've recorded a audiobook bit. My new book is out, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What You Can Do About It, and What We Can Do About It. And we recorded Chapter 7, which is a chapter about Bush's use of Hitler's techniques. And you know, I recorded it basically like a book on tape, and there's little clips in there of Eisenhower and of Hess introducing Hitler, actually. And it's over at 620kpoj.com if you want to hear it. It's free. You can download it. You can iPod it, whatever you'd like. It's an MP3 file. Just go to 620kpoj.com, which is a radio station where I do a morning show before I do this live national show. Angela in New York, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Angela, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Tom,
yeah.
Your guest that you had on,
yep.
you blew it. The issue that he started talking about was something that I think needs debate, and you asked him about assisted suicide. He started talking about another issue that really is something that's bothered me for a while that I've heard about, and that's where, especially in the state of Texas, where it's legal, doctors or these, what do you call them, biogenetic committees, can decide whether or not you, as a person, are allowed to have the life-sustaining treatment you requested. There was a very small blurb in the media when the Schiavo case was out there about a woman in Texas who wanted that type of treatment for her son and was turned down because of that law.
No, I understand that, and that's an area where he and I are probably not in disagreement. The area, and having looked over his book, I got it that he's absolutely against physician-assisted suicide. In fact, that's a large, probably 90% of his book is all about how physician-assisted suicide, as we have here in Oregon, inevitably leads to euthanasia. And the news hook that he's trying to use is the story in Texas. And so, no, I didn't blow it. I talked about what I wanted to talk about, which is these guys want to legislate against physician-assisted suicide. That's, they're using the Texas situation where we probably agree as the wedge. And you know, so.
But let me ask you this, Tom.
Yeah.
The issue of physician-assisted suicide, it's almost in that realm of the all-or-nothing debate with abortion. Don't you think that it's important also to get these other issues out there that other people might not even be aware of? And, you know, it's certainly more difficult once such a problem spreads to do something about it.
Yeah,
I
don't disagree, but I'll tell you, this is the issue really where these guys are going to make their stand, and what Oregon has done right now. John Ashcroft filed a lawsuit against the state back when he was Attorney General. It got knocked down, you know, by the Supreme Court. They didn't let it go through. But the Bush administration's been doing everything they can to try and take down a law that was passed not once but twice by the citizens of Oregon because the legislature didn't have the courage. It was passed by citizen initiative. And I'm telling you, when people get upset about something, they will stand up and fix it. And that's what happened in this state. And there's been this unrelenting, unremitting attack on it. And he and his book and his whole bunch are part of that. And they have a huge ally in the healthcare industry that would love to have people, you know, I mean, the longer you're in the hospital, the more money it makes for the hospital. And now that hospitals are for-profit businesses, and Bill Frist's daddy is one of the 50 richest men in America because of, you know, Hospital Corporation of America, there's big money in keeping people alive who don't want to stay alive. So that's that. Angela, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, that was the fundamental that I wanted to discuss with him, and I brought it back to that. Jason in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jason.
Oh, hey, I was just calling. I just wanted to make a comment. I only caught bits and pieces of what you guys were talking about. Is this guy a religious guy or?
Well, he doesn't make religious arguments, but yeah, I can't speak for him. I don't have any idea. He's doing the Catholic line, but I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Well, I just think that people just need to get off this stupid high horse and worry about things that really matter.
Yeah, his news release, goes on at length about how in Holland now, I think it was about 30 or 40 babies last year were euthanized. But then when you dig a little deeper, in other words, they were put to death after they were born, you dig a little deeper into the statistics, you discover that a quarter of those babies were not expected to live more than a week or two, and the majority of them were not expected to live more than a year. And here in the United States, we would keep them alive until they died. In Holland, they say, okay, that's it. Now, that's another area where it would be interesting to have a discussion. But
we're talking about elderly people and terminally ill people in Oregon, and this is not...
That's right. I was going to say, the issue that's real, where the rubber meets the road, is physician-assisted suicide. That's, in my opinion, that's the issue that we really need to be having a discussion about in the United States. And the cons don't even want us having that discussion, much less, God forbid, Jason, you and I here in Oregon having that law. So, anyhow, thank you.
Well, I mean, it just goes on to one more thing. It just goes on to the whole thing about religion and getting in way of our own rights and what we want. It's our body. Let's do what we want. I mean, give me a break. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jason. Well said. Fred in Springfield, Oregon. Hey, Fred.
Yes, hi. I think you made a good point, too, about this man's motives. I'd like to know sometimes what these people's real motives are for objecting to certain things. I mean, like... In the saving fetuses' lives, are they only into it because perhaps they're really into having these babies available for adoptions, and they want to make sure that they've got enough available for them?
Well, you've got what's his name, John, I forget his last name, the commentator on Fox News the other day saying white people have more babies.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they're hysterical about this.
That's right. And a few years back, about 10 years or more ago, they had a big issue in the magazines and papers about how the white population was dwindling. And at that time, I got to thinking, because the same thing was going on with the abortion issue. Why were they caring so much? Are they so afraid that the white population is dwindling? They've got to figure out a way to force whites to have more babies.
Well, I think there are some, like John Gibson of Fox News, who are into that. There are others who think that this is what their religion dictates. It's not in the Bible, but the Pope says it, and therefore it must be, God's will. Save us from people who are certain that they know God's will. Fred, thanks a lot for the call. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian.
Yeah, hi. I was kind of interested in the guy's original point and the fact he's getting his information from Texas, which I believe is a Republican state.
Yeah.
Am I wrong on that?
Yeah.
So you would think that they would have more conservative values and they wouldn't want to put people to death before the people want to die.
Well, it's not a matter of putting people to death. It's a matter of letting people die.
Well, yeah, but in Texas, it's if I understood him, he's saying patients actually don't want to die yet, and they want treatment, and doctors are refusing to give them treatment.
I'm going to have to dig into that a little more, Julian, before I can really speak about it. I'm not qualified to speak on that. Chris in Seattle. Hey, Chris, a Buddhist slant on this discussion?
Yeah, I just kind of wanted to just put it out there. Real quick, I just wanted to say about the, have more white people, have more babies. It just shows...
That was John Gibson's thing.
I didn't hear it, but it just shows that, racism and discrimination and bigotry, all that stuff is still prevalent. It's just gotten more undercover. It's just gotten more incognito. But I wouldn't, in people's minds, I wouldn't say it's, I'm sure, it's way better than the, civil rights movement. But I just wanted to comment that, racism on all sides is totally prevalent, And I hate to see so much, coverage of racism with white, when you ask, if you did a study and asked any American, just a big, huge number, what's the first thing they think of when they, you know, think of racist or whatever? They're going to say neo-Nazi or, you know, or KKK or something. I'll get to my quick point. I just wanted to point out that although the Buddhist, at least Tibetan, that I'm a part of, they believe that, you know, suicide is a is the most negative effect you could have on your being as far as negative energy.
Right, on your future, on your karma, as it were.
Exactly, you know, negative energy, bad karma. But I don't know whether this would be considered that. I think some people would twist the law and, you know, somebody that might be depressed might kill themselves, although there's plenty of ways to do it painlessly without, you know, this. But they also would be totally against anybody telling any form, organization, even single person telling any other human being what they should do.
I got it, Chris. I got it. I appreciate it.
Now it's time for my word. Do your duty. Make more babies.
This is John Gibson.
That's a lesson drawn out of two interesting stories over the last couple of days. First, a story yesterday that half of the kids in this country under 5 years old are minorities.
Uh-oh.
By far the greatest number are Hispanic.
Uh-oh.
You know what that means? 25 years and the majority population is Hispanic. Why is that? Well, Hispanics are having more kids and others, notably the ones Hispanics called gabachos, white people, are having fewer.
So, John Gibson, Fox News.
The rest of you get busy. Make babies. Or put another way, a slogan for our times. Procreation, not recreation. That's my word.
Yeah, that's John Gibson's word over at Fox News. Oh, man, what a weird world we're living in. 45 minutes past the hour, exposing the con and conservative, the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be right back.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Remember, democracy starts with you.
Tag your ears.
Okay, here's the situation. It took a few minutes to track this thing down because there's nothing that I can find about it. Texas isn't even in the index of this guy's book who was on our program, and none of the Texas information is here, although, you know, he's throwing this stuff out. Here's a piece from the Daily Texan, serving the University of Texas at Austin since 1900. Son, a six-month-old baby with lungs too tiny to breathe, was taken off a respirator at the Texas Children's Hospital in Houston earlier this month. He never would have been able to survive, even if doctors had continued treatment. But the decision to let son die was made by the hospital over the objections of his mother, Wanda Hudson. This is the story. It was in the news back 6-8 months ago. When the family wants terminal patients to continue treatment and the hospital disagrees, the hospital's ethic committee has the final say. That's the way it works in Texas under a 1999 law. That would have been passed when George W. Bush was governor. The spirit of the law is not inherently cruel. It was designed so that doctors who felt it was wrong to prolong the suffering of terminal patients in obvious pain would be able to refuse treatment. It requires that in any case where the doctor wishes to remove life-sustaining care against the wishes of the next of kin, provide 10 days notice, in which time the family may find another health care facility that will treat the patient. But in cases where the patient is clearly dying, it can be hard to find a health care facility to take on that patient for the same ethical reasons that the original hospital wished to end care so they would not prolong suffering. So this is what it gets down to, is this kind of thing. It's going to be a tough one. 1-866-440-8466. Bob in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bob.
How you doing, Tom? Thank you for being a voice.
Sure. What's up?
I remember hearing about the Texas Feudal Care Law, Health and Safety Code number 166, during the Terry Schiavo thing.
Yeah.
The sudden Hudson thing was happening at the same time.
Right.
And I had heard about Randy Rhodes. And I went and looked it up and printed it out. Originally, it was written that 72 hours after you ran out of Medicaid and or health insurance, the hospital can unplug you. That was, it was all basically framed around money. It had nothing to do with the, whether the physician thought that you would make it or not.
So this was originally written by Bill Frist's daddy.
I guess so. You know, they're so caring and everything.
Yeah.
It infuriated me at the time. I had printed it out. It was 32 pages. I was going through a major argument with my sister and my sisters and my mother about the whole Terri Schiavo thing and how we should stay out of it. I printed it out and they refused to read it.
Yeah. And if it was being promoted by the hospitals in the original form, you can understand why George Bush would have wanted to sign it as governor. But since then, they took out that part about the money.
No, the money's still there. Only they increased it to 10 days instead of 72 hours.
Oh man!
So that's
not good.
No, it's not good. And that was my. And with them, I'm saying, as this guy's flying up from Texas to sign a law for this one, you know, breathing cabbage in Florida, and I'm saying, well, they're putting people to death and who, you know, as the son Hudson's mother was pleading to keep her child alive.
Right, although that child was going to die.
Yeah, he was born with his heart on the outside of his body.
Right.
It wasn't inside, so he wasn't going to make it. But she was pleading to at least try, you know, do something. And they just went ahead, you know, Texas feudal care law, you know, George said
pull
it's all right.
Pull the plug. Interesting. Yeah. Bob, thanks for the tip and the heads up. I appreciate it. Kenny in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hey, Kenny.
Hey, Tom. Hi, thanks for taking my call. You made a comment, and the last two calls one reinforces one, and this past one reinforces the last one before that didn't. You, just as the commercial break was going on, you said, yeah, this hospital will keep you alive as long as possible to take all the money they can. It was kind of a quick comment. Maybe it was in the spirit of the moment, but I don't know if you really meant to say that or not.
I did mean to say that. I have had personal experience with that, and my take on it is that back when hospitals were not-for-profit organizations and most states required hospitals to be non-profit organizations, decisions were made based on what's best for the patient. And now, very often, decisions are made based on what's best for the economics of the hospital. Frankly, I don't think anybody can deny that.
Well, okay, but and maybe situations are different at different places. In my limited experience, where someone I know works, they are more pragmatic. When someone is obviously either brain dead or isn't going to survive or is just, you know, their life is being carried on unnecessarily, they aren't usually on the side of allowing the death to happen rather than prolonging.
Yeah, in other words, there are hospitals around the country that will do what Terri Schiavo's husband wanted done with Terri Schiavo, which is just let them die naturally. Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that, Kenny. I'm not saying the hospitals in all cases are extending
life. I don't think it can be just a general statement.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good point. Point well made. Tom in Fort Myers, Florida. Hey, Tom.
Hey, I just wanted to comment on something that was brought up a little earlier about, this partially being racially motivated to a certain extent, and a lot of what Gibson was saying. I mean, granted, he's a fun nut to listen to once in a while, but you know, too many people believe what he's saying about that. And, being in TV for 20 years, shooting video, been to many an abortion clinic protest and a couple of towns I lived in, you know, that the white neighborhood abortion clinic, you know, Planned Parenthood, that was the one being protested, but not the one in the middle income, what would be considered, you know, lower income, racially diverse area. No, they never had protesters there.
Oh,
but it was always in the white neighborhood, and I always thought that was, you know, a bit despicable of them, but, and then you get Gibson saying something about, we're all going to be brown. It's like, well, good.
Yeah. White people
every day a Republican dies and a Democrat's born, you know?
It may well be. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. I don't think that we break down politically along racial lines inherently. It's just that, you know, when the Republican Party followed Richard Nixon's advice of the Southern Strategy in 72 and became the party of racism, gee, you wonder why minorities would be more inclined to be Democratic. What a surprise. Oh, my. Well, 57 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program. Coming up after the news, Erwin Redliner of his new book, Americans at Risk. Can we deal with another disaster? 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Is torture big business? Is it profitable? Are we paying for it? Is it unprosecutable? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. We're going to explore some of those questions in just a minute. Just a quick heads up, those of you listening to the program today, the first hour I was live, as you probably noticed. The second hour, we played a segment that had been previously played before, a sort of best-of segment, so that I could do a fundraiser for another radio station. A whole long story. And now I'm back live again. Here we are. It's Tuesday. It's 6 minutes past the hour. And Tara McKelvey is with us, the senior editor at American Prospect, www.prospect.org, and a fellow at the New York University Law School's Center on Law and Security. Tara, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Am I pronouncing it right, Tara?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay. And this article, The Unaccountables, Profiteering in Iraq, this is shocking. You pulled this thing together for the Prospect, prospect.org. People can find the article, The Unaccountables, that Tara wrote some time ago. And the information in its various pieces has been all over the place, I suppose, for quite some time. But you just lay this out in such a nice, tight fashion. And with the, you know, and in a storytelling, I mean, you start out with the story of Adele, is it Nakhla?
Mm-hmm. Nakhla, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's begin at the beginning with this. What is the situation with regard to private contractors' involvement in torture in Iraq and around the world, for that matter, on behalf of the United States?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I mean, of course, if you ask the contractors, they would deny any responsibility or any involvement. There has been a lawsuit that was filed that accuses the contractors of being involved in some of the abuse cases at Abu Ghraib. And just sort of like the nuts and bolts of it, there's a whole lot of contractors over in Iraq. There's probably at least 25,000. I mean, some estimates are much higher.
It's the second largest army behind the U.S. Army. It's larger than the British Army.
Exactly. I mean, that's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty impressive force. And at Abu Ghraib alone, there were approximately 60 interrogators who were there at various times. And there were about 4,000 interpreters who were sent over to Iraq.
Now, these are all working for private for-profit corporations.
Exactly.
Not government employees. And therefore, they're not subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. They're not parts of the military. And they're apparently not subject to either Iraqi law or U.S. law.
Right. The situation for them is very murky. They can be prosecuted in the U.S., but the steps that they need to go through in order to end up in a court are very long, and so far it has not been very successful in terms of prosecution.
Why?
There's a lot of different explanations for it. Some people say that simply because the laws are so arcane or so complicated that that's been an obstacle. Other people, like human rights activists at Human Rights Watch and so on, say that the government has not pushed ahead on these cases like they should be because they don't have an interest in doing it.
We're talking with Tara McKelvey, senior editor at the American Prospect, prospect.org, the website, and a fellow at the NYU Law School's Center on Law and Security. Tara, I don't recall, although I did not go to Vietnam, but, you know, I was in the news business during that time. I was doing news in the 1970s, and I am very familiar with the situation. I don't recall private contractors playing a significant role in the Vietnam War. My recollection is that it was all pretty much draftees and volunteers, people who were in the U.S. military. Am I correct in that? And if so, what has produced the transition from the army or using the word generically, from the military, let's say, that is self-contained and that is answerable to we the people and that has its own code of honor and its own system of internal checks and balances, to this privatized mercenary force?
Well, I mean, you said the word draftee. You know, one thing that's played a role in it is getting enough people to send over to Iraq or to the countries where we're fighting, or to Afghanistan. In Vietnam, there were contractors. I'm sure they were. I mean, we've had contractors ever since George Washington was president, but they were not in such large numbers. And the government will say that it's an efficient way of, you know, running the military, and it's better to have companies do these things. But there's a scholar at Brookings Institute named P.W. Singer, and he says that the only studies that have shown any real savings for the military have been done by private contractors, and they've been forward-looking.
Yeah.
So we don't really know what the savings are for the military.
Well, and in fact, didn't Halliburton, prior to the Bush administration starting out, wasn't there a study done? In fact, my recollection is that this was Cheney put this thing together. Let's investigate whether private corporations should be doing many of these military functions. And then, oh, gee, yeah, they should. And maybe Halliburton should be the one doing it.
Yeah, I mean, Halliburton's the most famous example of the contractors. It's true. And on the other hand, though, you could say that most of the contractors are doing a good job. You know, they're out there and they're doing a lot of services that we don't have the people for. You know, the military is really strapped.
Because we don't have the draft.
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot of different reasons, but that's certainly one of them.
So, and then what has changed in Iraq? Tell us about how it came about that American citizens can go to Iraq and commit crimes. What would be crimes if they were done here in the United States? And what would have been crimes under Iraqi law and yet cannot be prosecuted by the government of Iraq?
Well, one of the things that happened is when first the troops went over, they had the Coalition Provisional Authority that was sort of this interim governing body for Iraq.
This was the thing that was put together by George Bush's old Andover roommate, Paul Bremer, right?
Yeah, exactly. I didn't remember the Andover part, but yes, it's the same guy.
Yeah.
And they established that soldiers and contractors would be immune from Iraqi law. And that meant that they could never be prosecuted in an Iraqi court. And if it were the soldiers, then that would mean they would then be court-martialed in the U.S. if they did something wrong when they were in Iraq. The contractors, of course, would not be court-martialed because they're not in the military. And that's where things get a little bit, you know, foggy for the contractors.
And thus we end up with a situation where where we are, America, is painted with the brush of war criminals, essentially. And yet we don't have an internal system of accountability for this.
Right. Well, people would say that the system exists, sort of technically. Mm-hmm. Contractors can be prosecuted. There's the Patriot Act. They can be prosecuted under that, or they can be prosecuted under a law called the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act. But in practice, very few of them have been prosecuted, and most of the investigations are at a standstill.
Now, is that because there have been very few crimes?
Well, I mean, there are at least 15 cases that were referred to the Department of Justice. And that's the ones that we know about. I mean, if you consider that there's 25,000 contractors in Iraq, I mean, you know, unless they're all like complete angels, there's going to be a fair number of people who could be prosecuted for crimes.
Are we talking about people who have been, for example, tortured to death?
Well, there was a case that was recent. There was a contractor who was working for the CIA. His name was David Pissarro, and he was accused of beating a detainee in Afghanistan. And shortly afterwards, the detainee died. He was found guilty, and that happened on August 17th.
So then does that mean that the system is working?
It would be nice to think it does. I mean, I was surprised that he was found guilty. I didn't expect it to happen. But he was, and he's going to be sentenced. It can be anywhere between 2 and 11.5 years in prison.
Or is this the sort of thing that you do, so, you know, the occasional show trial, so that it looks like you're taking care of business when, in fact, you know,
Yeah.
These poor grunts, in the military term, you know, at Abu Ghraib who were busted. I mean, they were behaving.
Yeah.
What they were doing was conduct that was driven from the top down. I mean, sanctioned from George W. Bush and Don Rumsfeld all the way down, and yet they're the ones who took the fall for it.
Yeah, certainly the lower level soldiers have been the ones that have been court-martialed.
So is it the same in the contractor world? Are any of the contracting companies being held accountable for the behavior of their people?
I think we're a long way from that. I mean, we're barely scratching the surface on having the contractors themselves held liable.
So how do we increase the responsibility How do we increase the accountability in this?
I think
we just have a few seconds left. I'm sorry.
Oh, sure. I think that the guy who was found guilty in North Carolina is a sign that the North Carolina jury found him guilty. You know, they said he was beating a man who may have been a suspect or may have been guilty of committing attacks on U.S. forces, but still what he did was wrong and he should be held liable. I think that's a sign that Americans are looking at this differently.
Yeah, and Americans may be beginning to wake up to the horrors of this whole thing, this whole bizarre response to 9/11 that George Bush has brought forward. Tara McKelvey, prospect.org, the website. She's a senior editor there and a fellow at the NYU Law School Center on Law and Security. Tara, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Great speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm a shot dick at my name. Sometimes I shoot without taking aim. Hurt a duck if you know I'm good for you. Old Harry got peppered with buckshot spray, but I didn't say nothing till the very next day. Like I talked the president. Watch your face and pull the trigger quick. We're just a bunch of good old boys out hunting quail. I don't mean that. I'm buckshot, buckshot, buckshot dick. Keep it quiet, that's my trick. Any other kind of man might be in jail.
And welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, look out for buckshot dick. Duck! No. Not a duck over there. No, you duck! Welcome back. Oh, man. Our program, by the way, brought to you today by Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. Their telephone number, 1-800-425-2532. I got to say, not just brought to you by Sacred Grounds, powered by Sacred Grounds Coffee. It's the best coffee in the world. 1-800-425-2532, their telephone number, sacredgroundscoffee.com, their website, and Small Dog Electronics. Get the latest iPod now, all things Macintosh, all things iPod, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, or smalldog.com, their website. Let's check out what's going on with the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight and to die. And there are lies in the balance. There are demons on the fire. There are children at the camp. And there is blood on the rise.
Following our security and other developments in Iraq, reported on Tuesday as of 0630 GMT by Reuters. Dateline Mosul, gunmen killed four members of a Kurdish family and wounded a fifth after they broke into their house in eastern Mosul, 390 kilometers north of Baghdad, according to hospital sources. In Baghdad, three civilians were wounded when their car was struck by a roadside bomb in Talbiya district, according to Interior Ministry source. In Khan Bani Sa'ad, gunmen attacked overnight a Shiite mosque in this town south of the ethnically volatile city of Bakhaba, killing seven and wounding others, according to state television. They said six mortar rounds landed in the mosque and destroyed it. A resident reported hearing clashes overnight. In other developments, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki flew to Tehran for his first official visit to neighboring Shiite Iran, Iraq's state-run television said. That's interesting. We won't talk to Iran. Our president won't talk to Iran. We won't send an ambassador to Iran. But the prime minister of Iraq hops on a plane and goes to Tehran. What do they know we don't know? And also the trial of Saddam Hussein and six co-accused for the killings of tens of thousands of Kurds in 1988 resumed in a Baghdad courtroom. let's see, 1988. That would have been the year that Ronald Reagan was supporting Saddam Hussein and George Herbert Walker Bush was vice president. Around the world, newspapers responding to 9/11 and responding to Bush's response to 9/11. This is from Agence France-Presse. The headline, Global Media Abhors U.S. Response to 9/11. Newspapers across the world have strongly criticized the U.S. response to September 11, accusing the Bush administration of bungling its, quote, war on terror, end quote, and squandering global goodwill by invading Iraq. Now, here's just some samples. In the British press, for example, the conservative Financial Times. The Financial Times in England is like the Wall Street Journal in the United States. It's probably the most conservative publication that's not, you know, basically a party organ. Financial Times. Quote, the way the Bush administration has trampled on the international rule of law and Geneva conventions while abrogating civil liberties and expanding executive power at home has done huge damage not only to America's reputation but more broadly to the attractive power of Western values. In Germany, the daily paper Handelsblatt, I used to read that when I lived there, said the war in Iraq has been erroneously started in the name of September 11. In Spain, the El País newspaper said the Bush administration used the attacks to impose a neoconservative foreign policy. The result, El País said, 5 years after, is a more dangerous world. That from our ally Spain. In Lebanon, the Daily Star said, quote, instead of isolating and wiping out al-Qaeda, Bush has created a long list of new foes in his ever-broadening war on terror. In doing so, he has bolstered the popular impression that the United States is waging a crusade against Islam, an impression which al-Qaeda skillfully exploits in order to gain more support. In Egypt, the newspaper Al-Aram, which operates, by the way, you know, with the consent of the government, not the governed, says they compared Bush to Osama bin Laden. 5 years ago, the history of the world changed twice, once in the hands of bin Laden and his gang, and once in the hands of bin Bush and his administration. Now, this is quoting from what is, for all practical purposes, the official Egyptian newspaper. We're in deep trouble, my friends. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
All I want is to have some fun. Those birds can't fly. Hell, they can hardly run. But it sure is not being out here on the range. Blast some shot all over the place. Poor Harry took some in the face. Another case of friendly fire for a change. Buckshot Dick, watch your face, I'm pulling triggers quick. We're just a bunch of good old boys out hunting quail. I'm Buckshot, Buckshot, Buckshot Dick. Keep it quiet, that's my trick. Any other kind of man might be in jail.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. That's me, 35 minutes past the hour, and glad to be back here with you. Newspapers across the world criticizing the U.S. response to 9/11 on the fifth anniversary yesterday of 9/11, including the semi-official Egyptian newspaper in Pakistan, a key U.S. ally in the battle against al-Qaeda. The Daily News wrote an editorial, again, a newspaper that would not exist without the approval of military dictator Perez Musharraf. The title is 5 Years of Nothing. This is what the editorial in the Daily News in Pakistan said. Quote, looking back, it would be hard to say whether the years have been spent in something meaningful or constructive. Many would agree the world is a more dangerous place and the United States is nowhere close to winning the war on terror. That's like saying, you know, let's fight a war against bullets. Yeah, we're fighting a war against bullets. Actually, bullets are a product. It's a, more of a strategy. But in the meantime, we have good old Crystal and Lowry, Weekly Standard editor Bill Crystal, out there with Fox News and Rich Lowry claiming, it would just be a wonderful thing if we sent more people into Iraq. You get this? This was on Fox News. This is mind-boggling.
When it comes to Iraq, Rich, you and Bill Crystal wrote a piece recently suggesting that we need more troops in Iraq. If the president were to call for that right now, what do you think of the reaction would be?
Well, I have a view that's counter to the conventional wisdom on that. I think what's dragging Bush down on Iraq, or a big part of it, is that people are not convinced that he has a plan for victory. And I think if he frankly acknowledged the crisis situation on the ground in Baghdad, as he has begun to, he's used the word crisis in a speech recently, and said, look, this is how we're going to deal with it. We're going to send two more divisions into that city and really lock it down and secure it. And I think people would actually react favorably to that. And the one encouraging thing in Iraq, John, despite all the distressing news, is in those neighborhoods in Baghdad that are intensively patrolled by Americans, they are more secure. And we are able to make progress when we have the guys on the ground to do it. And I just believe that we need more guys on the ground.
Those neighborhoods like the Green Zone. Come on. Yes, we just need a Tet Offensive. We just need a Christmas bombing. That's all we need. Just, you know, let's just send a few more thousand guys over there. Rich, we've seen this movie before. People don't like their countries being occupied by Americans or anybody else. And when their countries get occupied, they shoot at the occupiers. How about reading some history, Mr. Lowry? As they point out over at Think Progress. First, there is no indication from public polling that there is any U.S. support for increasing troop levels in Iraq. 17% of Americans support increasing force levels, according to a recent ABC News Washington Post poll. 53% of Americans are in favor of decreasing force strength in Iraq. Second, the argument wrongly suggests that violence in Iraq is constricted to Baghdad. In fact, they note at Think Progress, as the senior Marine intelligence officer in charge of Western Iraq reported, the political and economic security situation there, this is not Baghdad, this is Western Iraq, is rapidly destabilizing. Third, escalation is the wrong remedy to the problem because it fails to understand the root cause of the problem. The root cause of the problem is the belief by the people there that we're an invading, occupying force. And, gee, we are! I mean, they remember very well. They remember very well.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of world oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
And
your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
They remember it very well, the vice president talking about, gee, look at all the oil they've got. And the president saying, yeah, we're going to start bombing you. By the way, don't destroy those oil wells. We want them. This is crazy. In the meantime, El-Zawahiri, they refer to him as Osama bin Laden's deputy. You know, I find this interesting. I think that most of the news organizations really don't understand the history of Al-Qaeda. First of all, one of the reasons why Al-Qaeda is so resilient is because it is not a top-down organization. It is organized like a family, you know, with cousins and uncles and nephews and patriarchs and matriarchs and not many matriarchs, frankly, but you get the point. And secondly, El-Zawahiri was the guy who was the student of Qutb, who was the Egyptian who came to the United States and saw how decadent our society was back in the 1950s. As the middle class was emerging and saying, holy cow, middle class and women asking for rights and minorities wanting rights and gays wanting rights. Holy, we can't have this. And they're going to do this to Egypt. And he went back to Egypt and founded the Muslim Brotherhood and assassinated Anwar Sadat. And, you know, on it went. I mean, you know, tried to assassinate Nasser, got put in prison, got tortured, got executed. And his student, al-Zawahiri, a pediatrician, as I recall, I know he's a physician, I'm pretty sure he was a pediatrician. He went to Afghanistan, you know, he fled Egypt because the Muslim Brotherhood was under attack at that time. Goes to Afghanistan, sets up shop, and when Osama bin Laden comes to Afghanistan, he becomes the student of al-Zawahiri. Or al-Zawahiri. So, you know, they call him his deputy. They call him Osama bin Laden's deputy. I would say he's Osama bin Laden's mentor. But in any case, here's the story from the Associated Press. Osama bin Laden's deputy warned that Persian Gulf countries and Israel would be al-Qaeda's next targets, according to a new videotape aired by Arab broadcaster Al Jazeera on Monday, the fifth anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Ayman al-Zawahiri accused the governments of Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia of supporting Israel's war against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Addressing the West, the al-Qaeda number two said, quote, "You should not waste your time in reinforcing your troops in Iraq and Afghanistan because they are doomed to defeat and are already all but defeated." Now, you get this. This is brilliant on two levels. Number one, he's doing the same thing George Bush does here. He's playing to his base.
Hey, we got a war going, and we got to get out there. We got to fight it. Yeah, well, more war, more killing. Yeah, let's our team, their team, yeah.
So he's doing that. At the same time, the one thing that Osama bin Laden and al-Zawahiri have wanted from the very get-go, the reason why they were attacking the United States in the first place, is because they were basically a mosquito trying to take on an elephant. And they didn't want to be a mosquito. They wanted to become a hummingbird, and then they wanted to become a buzzard. And then, you know, I don't know how far you can push the animal metaphor, but the point is they wanted to be taken seriously. They wanted to be the big shots. They wanted the whole world to notice them. And attacking the elephant seemed like, you know, a really good way to do it. And so by saying to us, taunting us,
you're doomed, you're going to be defeated.
First of all, it makes it harder for the people in the United States who are rational voices saying, don't take that bait. Don't you understand? This is Brer Rabbit sitting there in the middle of the briar patch saying, you know, please don't come into the briar patch and get me. I mean, you know, it's just, I mean, don't do it. Those voices that are saying, you know, like on the Republican side, Chuck Hagel, the former president of the voting machine company, or on the Democratic side, well, pretty much everybody. It started, of course, with Jack Murtha, who was the first to really speak out in a way that was taken seriously. It started with Dennis Kucinich, but that goes way back. But those voices who are saying, you know, we're not going to, quote, win, end quote, this, quote, war, end quote, by killing more people and dropping more bombs. We're going to win it the same way that the Palestinian territories were won by Hamas, and the same way that southern Lebanon was won by Hezbollah. We're going to win it by building hospitals, by feeding people, by building schools, by being the good guys, not the bad guys. And, I mean, just consider this. So this is not rocket science. But he, by saying this, I mean, this is so brilliant, by saying this, he's going to marginalize those voices in mainstream America who are saying, you know, maybe we should set a deadline and get out of there. And he's going to make it a whole lot, it's like this guy, the al-Qaeda and Bush are like the two sides of the same coin. And they're doing this very, very subtle dance together that works to the benefit of both of them, but screws America and kills people in the Middle East. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, but ain't that America? You and me.
that America? Something to free, baby. Ain't that America? Home on the free, yeah. Little pink algae for you and me.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. A few of the things Bush didn't talk about last night. This compilation, courtesy of Jamie Holly, posting over at crooksandliars.com. CIA counterterrorism officers are signing up in growing numbers for a government-reimbursed private insurance plan that would pay their civil judgments and legal expenses if they're sued or charged with criminal wrongdoing, according to current and former intelligence officials and others with knowledge of the program. The new enrollments reflect heightened anxiety at the CIA that officers may be vulnerable to accusations they were involved in abuse, torture, human rights violations, and other illegal misconduct, including wrongdoing related to the September 11, 2001 attacks. Say what? They worry that they will not have Justice Department representation in court or congressional inquiries, the officials said. Something Bush didn't mention in his speech last night. No, didn't get into it. Condi Rice still claiming that there was a relationship between Iraq and 9/11. Even though, I mean, even in his speech last night, George W. Bush says...
I'm often asked why we're in Iraq when Saddam Hussein was not responsible for the 9/11 attacks.
Yeah, often asked that. Well, Condi Rice, giving a series of interviews ahead of the fifth anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, brushed aside a recently released U.S. intelligence report saying there is no evidence Saddam's regime was helping al-Qaeda obtain arms. On Fox News Sunday, she said, and I quote, "There were ties between Iraq and al-Qaeda," end quote. Yeah. Another thing that George W. Bush probably, well, not probably, didn't talk about in his speech. I mean, in the past, he's said, you know.
So I don't know where he is. Nor, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him. I'll be honest with you. Again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
Yeah. Seriously.
I'm not making this up.
Yeah, no, seriously. And, well, here's what's happened. The clandestine U.S. commandos, whose job is to capture or kill Osama bin Laden, have not received a credible lead in more than 2 years. The bin Laden trail is stone cold. Nothing from the vast U.S. intelligence world, no tips from informants, no snippets from electronic intercepts, no points on any satellite image has led them anywhere near the al-Qaeda leader, according to the U.S. and Pakistani officials. Quote, "The handful of assets that we have given us nothing close to real-time intelligence that could lead to his capture," said one counterterrorism official, who said the trail, despite the most extensive manhunt in U.S. history, has gone, quote, stone cold, end quote. Bush didn't mention that. Somehow he just kind of overlooked it, I guess. He also didn't mention the establishment of the Islamic Emirate of Waziristan. No, this isn't, you know, one of those funny names that are made up, and it's not from Risk or something like that. No, this is a truce has been signed with a region of Pakistan. There are actually two of them, North Waziristan and South Waziristan. This is North Waziristan. It's the area that is south of the federally administered tribal areas that are due east of Kabul. If Kabul was Detroit, let's see if I can come up with a better. You see, I grew up in the Midwest. I mean, so if Kabul was Lansing, Michigan, then Waziristan would be the Detroit area. I mean, that's basically what it is. You know, it's 150 miles or so west-southwest of Kabul. North Waziristan. This is where they believe that bin Laden and his friends are. Okay. And here's the story. The Pakistani government has signed a truce agreement with the Taliban in North Waziristan. And for all practical purposes, this is a surrender. I mean, let's just call this what it is. The details, I mean, this is from BillRiggio.com, is the guy who wrote this originally at his blog. The Pakistani army is abandoning its garrisons in North and South Waziristan. The Pakistani military will not operate in North Waziristan, nor will it monitor actions in the region. Pakistan is going to turn over their weapons and other equipment seized during the Pakistani army operations. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda have set up a Mujahideen Sharia, a council, to administer the area. The truce refers to the region as the Islamic Emirate of Waziristan. An unknown quantity of money was transferred from Pakistani government coffers to the Taliban. The Pakistani government has essentially paid a tribute or a ransom to end the fighting. Foreigners, in quotes, this is a euphemism for Al-Qaeda and other foreign jihadis, are allowed to remain in the region. Gee, that might mean like a 6-foot-4 tall Saudi Arabian guy with a dialysis machine. Over 130 mid-level Al-Qaeda commanders and foot soldiers were released from Pakistani custody. I mean, Bush didn't mention that either. Coming up on tomorrow's program, I'll be disagreeing with conservative Thomas Kilgannon, who is asking for a diplomatic divorce from the UN in his new book, and we'll be finding out if Greg Palast is fitted yet for an orange jumpsuit right here on the program, the Tom Hartman radio program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.